We're holding on Memvov Amud Beis by the second Mishnah. Continuing on topics having to do with Tikkun HaOlam, and this one going back to what we were talking about as far as Pidyon Shvuyim and related things earlier in the Perek, the Mishnah says, "Hamocher es atme ves bonov lo'od k'favim." If somebody sells himself and his children to Goyim, and as we're going to see in the Gemara, he's doing it multiple times. Ein poidin oisai, then we do not redeem him because since he's doing this regularly, then he's doing it basically because he figures he's relying on the fact that his fellow Jews are going to be generous and are going to buy him back from that. And there comes a point already where we say enough. You know, you can't keep on imposing on the tzibur like that. However, you do redeem the sons after their father dies, because we don't want the children to be assimilated among and lost among the goyim altogether. So as long as he's alive, then fine. We can sort of figure maybe he'll prevent them from assimilating completely. But once he's gone, then we have more to be concerned about. So therefore, we need to redeem them. So the Gemara says, Amar Avasi, v'ushamocha b'shonet v'shilish. This is only if he's done it three times. So he sold himself to get some money for himself, and Jews ransomed him, and then he did it again, and now he did it a third time. So now we say at that point, then we say, we give up on him. You never give up on a yid, but we say at this point, in other words, he can't keep on imposing on the tzibur, and therefore we're not going to be poor to him anymore. Abba Pashtus, his relatives still have a responsibility to. We're saying that the tzibur shouldn't, but the Pashtus, his relatives still have a responsibility to make sure that Itaka doesn't assimilate. Anyway, so the Gemara tells, Hanu b'nei bei michsi, there were people from a place called bei michsi, Jews, de yazfi zuzi me'ovdi kachavim, they borrowed money, or they were borrowing money regularly from goyim, and then they didn't have what to pay back the goyim with. Also, because garbi lahu, so the goyim were coming and grabbing them and taking them prisoner in payment of the debt. Also, kamei ravuna, so they came to ravuna to ask him to do pidyon shvuyim. So he says, my eved lahu, what can I do for you? The Tanan. We learned in the Mishnah. So therefore, so you've in effect sold yourselves to Goyim by borrowing money where you knew you're not going to have the ability to pay back So I can't. So Rav Abba says, what do you mean that you can't first time? Limatani Rabbeinu, you yourself taught us Rebbe. That this is only if he does it multiple times. This is the first time these people were actually captured by the goyim. So how is that? Oh, maybe not. Maybe Rav Abba didn't know whether it's the first time or not. Amalei, so Rav Yehuna tells him, that's exactly it. Hani mirgo regili da avdi hochi. These people are regularly doing this kind of thing. They borrow money knowing that they don't have what to pay back, and that the goyim are gonna take them prisoner. And then they're relying on the fact that the tzibur will ransom them, and you can't do that. That's what the Mishnah is saying, that you can't do that. Actually, that's most of the Rishonim seem to understand it that way. The Meiri actually says that Rav Huna may even mean this is the first time, but this is we know that they live in a place where the goyim are regularly going to do that to people who don't pay their debts. And therefore, even the first time already, they should know, not because they themselves went through it three times, but because enough other people have gone through the same thing, that they shouldn't be relying on that and borrowing money in the first place, where they know they may not be able to pay it back. And therefore, either way, the point is, Rav Huna is saying that's the case where the case of our Mishnah would apply, that we're not matriach on the tzibur to ransom them. So the Gemara tells in this connection, how who gavra the zabin nafshe ludoi. There was a man who had sold himself to the ludoi. Now Rashi explains here and in some other places in Shas that the ludoi were cannibals. So Poshet, they would eat people. So this guy sold himself to them as a slave, where the idea is that eventually they might even kill him and eat him. Also, the Rav Ami. So he came to Rav Ami to ask to do Pidyon Shvuyim. Omalei, and he says to Rav Ami, Pirkon. He says, ransom me from the Ludoi. So, we could assume maybe he didn't know in the first place what these people were. Maybe he was just doing it, again, in order to take advantage. Maybe he figured this way he has an easy way of raising money or something. You know, I'll do that, then I'll go to the Ami and plead that I'm going to get eaten, and therefore I'll have Rachmanos on me. So we don't know what he was thinking. But anyway, Omalei. Rav Ami answers. Actually, Hagoyes Habach takes out the word lay, because the pashtus, he wasn't necessarily saying this to the yid. This yid is not necessarily you can't really teach him a mishnah to explain to him what the halacha is. So apparently, the Bach understands that this is actually Rav Ami speaking to his talmidim and trying to figure out what we should do. So he says, Omar Le Tnan, what we learn in the Mishnah, Murchatim of Ezbonav Lodi Chavim, Ein Poydinosoi, Avo Poydimus Abonim. But we said in the Mishnah, we do ransom the children after their father died. And the reason is Mishum Kilkula, because otherwise they're going to get messed up. They're going to get assimilated among the Goyim and learn from them. At least as long as their father is alive, then he's going to prevent them from that. So that being the case, then if we see that we're concerned about Kilkul, and then we say, when we say that, then we say that we're not even going to worry about the fact that he did something improper, or we're still gonna put in the extra mile in order to ransom these children. Well, then Rav Ami thinks to himself, all the more so over here, where the person is in danger of being killed, then we should ransom him. No. So the Chachamim said to Rav Ami, this is a different case. Hi Yisrael Mumahu. This guy is actually Yisrael Mumer. We see that he regularly eats Nevelos Atreifus. So that being the case, then he's a Mumer. It's called, there's two different kinds of Mumer. There's a Mumer L'chol HaTorah Kula, where a person has completely thrown off Yiddishkeit, Rachman L'Tzlan, and is not keeping any mitzvahs. And then you have Mumer L'Dover Echad, which is that there's one particular mitzvah that he acts as though that mitzvah doesn't exist. This guy is doing that as far as eating kosher food. He's always eating Nevelos HaTreifus. So that in that case, then you have a different din about such a person. We learn in a Gemara in Avodah Zarah that you don't even necessarily save such a person's life, let alone you don't even try to arrange circumstances where to get rid of him, certainly not to go save him. So Rav Ami says, I hear what you're saying, but maybe he's only eating latte oven, in which case then, so they're saying the fact that he's eating nevelus like that all the time, they're arguing makes him not just a mumu, but makes him a min. And a min, the Gemara says, we throw them down into a pit, for example, to that they should die over there, and we certainly don't bring them out of it. So they're arguing that you shouldn't be working to save this guy's life. So Rav Ami is answering, maybe he's not a min, maybe he's only a mumer. So he's doing lute oven, meaning, and when it comes to this kind of thing, where a person is doing such averus, you can talk about where he's doing lute oven, which is that because he likes the taste better or because it's cheaper or whatever. But if there was kosher food available that was just as good and available to him at the same price, then he would eat it. He has nothing particular that he has to eat today for food. It's just he figures he can't afford it. That's called lute oven. Versus lahachis, where a person eats today for food, davke, in order to anger Hashem, even though the kosher food is just as available and just as cheap and so forth. So Rav Ami is arguing to be Malamed Schus on this guy. Maybe he's only a mumer l'tei oven. And in that case, he's not so bad. In that case, we should work on the basis of this Kal v'Chomer to save his life. Omrulei, but the other Chachamim from the Yeshiva, Rav Ami's Talmidim, said to him, no, v'hozimnen de'ikah hetera v'isura kamei, we see sometimes that there's heter and isur in front of him, v'shovik hetera v'ochel isura, and he sets aside the heter and he eats the isur. So even though both of them are perfectly available, then he's davka eating the isur. That makes him a mumu l'hachis, which is tantamount to being a min. So therefore we shouldn't be saving him. Amalei, so finally, after this whole discussion, Rav Ami tells the Yid, Zil, you're going to have to go. Loi kashavki li de'efrikinach. The other Chachamim are not allowing me to ransom you because you really don't fit the criteria for being, ransomed. In other words, basically, he's telling the Yid, you know, you messed up too far at this point for the Tzibur to be helping you. If you want help at this point, you're going to need to get it from individuals or Davin Tashem to help you and do tshuva. But the Tzibur at this point can't be burdened with helping you because of the way you've been acting. Chassam Sofer has a long discussion about this explanation. About this whole Gemara. He says the vort is if we're, so, what are we saying? You normally you poyder the children in order to prevent them from being lost among the goyim. But after all, don't you have the consideration in that case? If you do that again and again, then the father is going to have the incentive. He's going to say, okay, well then I can sell my children, and no, I can always rely on the tzibur, or even he'll sell them once, even whatever. But he'll know even if I die, or when I die, then the tzibur will take care of my children, and therefore, so don't we have that to be concerned as well? So on the face of it, then, so what we're saying is, if we figure the father is going to die of natural causes, then we're poor to the children here, where the father may end up getting eaten by the ludoi. Then therefore, maybe we should override that. Rav Ami was saying, and we should and we should be poor to them. And after all, you know, we know, Chassam Sofer points out, you have the vort also, Hamachti la'odim koshim and ahurgoi. It's true that making a person do averis is in a way worse than killing them. So doesn't that cause Rav Ami's kavachomer to fall apart? He's saying that if we save them, even when there's only a possibility of assimilation, how much more so when there's a possibility of him being killed? On the face of it, that doesn't fit with that idea. Hamachti la'odim koshim and ahurgoi. But Chassam Sofer says, the fact is, at least, on the other hand, a machti la'odim, it is possible for him to do tshuva. If he's killed, he won't. And with the children, it's even more so. With the children, after all, they'll be classic tinokas shenishbu, literally. So therefore, in that sense, then, for them or for their father to be killed is worse. And therefore, Rav Ami thought to save him. And only because these Talmidim are telling him that this guy is very far gone anyway, then therefore, it's not something where the tzibur is going to help him with pidyon shvuyim. He'll have to be helped in other ways. So the Gemara continues in this connection, since we're talking about people selling themselves to Ludim. So the Gemara mentions a similar story involving Rish Lakish. With that said, though, there is, for example, basically what we're saying over here is, if it weren't for the fact that this guy was a mumer lahachis, then we would have saved him because of the concern about him being killed. So therefore, we see from that even if a yid has caused these circumstances that put him in danger, nevertheless, we still work on doing pidyon shvuyim, which is very negeya nowadays. Sometimes, unfortunately, you have a yid who ends up in jail for one reason or another, and many times people will say, "Well, it's his fault. He did such and such dishonest, or he shouldn't have carried that luggage," or whatever it is. But the fact is, we see from this Gemara that even a guy who actually went and sold himself to the Ludim, because when there's Sakonis Nefoshis involved, then we still go the extra mile to be paid to him. Okay, so now the Gemara says, Rish Lakish Zobin Nafshe Luludoi. Rish Lakish one time did the same kind of thing. He sold himself to the Ludoi. Now Tosfos points out, we know famously that Rish Lakish at one point was a bandit and whatever before Rabbi Yochanan got him to do tshuva and become one of the great chachamim. So Tosfos says this story must have taken place before he did tshuva, because once he did tshuva, once he became a Talmid Chacham, he's not going to go be, even though, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, he actually was able to destroy the Ludoi. Nevertheless, though, he still wouldn't have done that if he was already a Talmid Chacham. He wouldn't have been mezalzel in himself so much. So it must have been during the time in between over there. Tosfos actually elsewhere learns that Rish Lakish started out as a Talmid Chacham, then went off the derech. And during that time is when he was a bandit and whatever. And that would be, again, during that time is when this story took place. And then later on, Rabbi Yochanan got him to do tshuva and become the Talmid Chacham and the Frum Yid that he was originally. Anyway, so he sold himself to the Ludoi. Shoko Badi Chaisa B'Gaugalta. He took along with him, when he sold himself to them, a bag and a Gaugalta, a wound thing, So the bag was tied up, Rashi says. Inside it was a round thing, like a kind of ball that you use in connection with spinning, with something heavy made out of stone or lead inside it. In fact, there's a slightly different gear set that the Oroch has, not the Galta, but Uglola, which means a piece of marble. Either way, the point is it was a bag where on the outside you wouldn't realize there's anything unusual about it, but inside there's some kind of heavy, deadly thing. Omar, he thinks to himself, Gmiri, we know for a fact, the Yom Basra, on the last day before these Ludoi kill somebody, called the Boy Minayu Abdilei. Whatever the victim asks, they give to him, Kihechi de Leichol Adome, so that way he will be Moichol on his blood. So that way, they use that to sort of ease their conscience and say, even those Ludoi, I guess, have a certain amount of a conscience. And therefore, they figure it'll make him feel better. And therefore, that way he'll be moichel on the fact that they're killing him. Rashi gives a second explanation the Oruch gives a second explanation that leichol adome means that his blood should be sweet. That in other words, like this, when they eat him and drink his blood, then it'll be sweeter than it otherwise would because he has the mental satisfaction before he died that they did whatever he wanted. So he figures, in other words, in short, they're going to give me my last wish. So Yom Basra, it came that last day when they were going to kill him. Omrule my nichaloch. So they ask him, what do you want? What's your last wish? He tells them, but I want to tie you up and have you sit there. And each one of you, I'm going to give 1.5 blows with this bag. Now they didn't realize there was anything the matter with the bag. To them, it just looked like an empty bag. So in that case, fine. He's going to give us a blow and a half of the bag. Big deal. It's not going to bother us. If that's his last wish, then fine. So sure enough, continu voisvinu. So he tied them up and sat them down. Now, as soon as he hit each one of them with only the one blow, and we have to remember there were other Gemaras that tell us that Rish Lakish was very big and powerful, so the one blow from him already was enough. Nothak nishmase, the guy's neshama left him, which doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't necessarily, so it could be that he died, or it could be like he was stunned. But chakine l'shine, as he was dying, he like gritted his teeth in a way that made it sound a little bit like a sound of laughter. But Pashtus, I guess we have to understand that Rish Lakish had each of them in a separate room or in a separate area or something, so the others don't see what's going on, otherwise they would stop him. So the first one, for example, he goes and hits him with the one blow, again, with this bag, with this very heavy thing inside it. And then the guy dies, and he grits his teeth and makes a sound that sounds like laughter. So the people in the other room or whatever can hear a sound that sounds like laughter. Omalei, so Rish Lakish says, pretending, play acting over here, you're laughing at me, akati poshlach gabi, pauga de chaisa, I still have the half a blow left to give you. Because I only gave you the one so far. So sure enough, in this way, Katlinu Lakulu, so in this way, he killed off all of them. So you know, we could understand that Rish Lakish, to begin with, being a smart Yid, had maybe sold himself to them to begin with, having this idea in mind. But Pashtos, that's the idea, since the Gemara is telling us that he took along the bag and the ball over there. And it means to begin with, he figured he's in a unique position by doing this to be able to finally be able to get rid of these guys once and for all. And this is how he went about doing it. Al derech, like you have certain rare tzaddikim that go down into places of tumah in order to extract kedusha from it, or in this case with Rish Lakish to destroy it altogether from within. And the Chassam Sofer has a vote on this, actually. He says that the symbolism behind it, what's this idea of a blow and a half? He says you have a person has a Yetzirah, and the Yetzirah is like a man-eating thing. It's trying to destroy and then eat up the person. So what do? You have two things to counteract them. You have learning Torah, which is called Chaisa, Meloshin Chayus, because you have Chayus in learning Torah. And then you also have, the Gemara tells us in Brachas, that if a person learns Torah and finds his Yetzirah is still getting the better of him, then Yazkiu lo Yom HaMisa, then he should remind the Yetzirah that one day he's going to die, and therefore that should help. That's like a last and like an emergency measure to keep the Yetzirah in check. But Chassam Sofer points out, after all, the Gemara is calling it only half in the sense that can backfire. After all, a person could say, I'm going to die, and the Yetzer Hara will say, well, then good, as long as you're still alive, live it up, and don't worry about Torah and Mitzvah. So therefore, that's what we're saying over here. Rish Lakish destroyed them just with the Chaisa, just with the one blow. He doesn't even need the Palga. He doesn't even need to remind his Yetzer Hara about Yom HaMisa, because just this power of Torah itself was enough to counteract and destroy his Yetzer Hara. And in that way, he destroyed the Ludoi. There's also a vote that the Toldos Yaakov Yosef brings a vote from the Baal Shem Tov on this Gemara, but he doesn't really explain it. He says something along the lines of, when a person has done a mitzvah and the Yetzer Hara comes to convince him, look what a wonderful guy you are, you did such a mitzvah, become a Baal Gaiva from it. So somehow he connects that with this idea, maybe because we're saying that the guy looked like he was laughing over there, so maybe that has something to do with it, but he doesn't really elaborate enough, for at least not for me, to be able to understand the vote. Maram Shif, by the way, points out there's an expression in the Gemara in some places that says when a person did a business deal that was a little bit risky, and then it turns out that the risk did come true, and now he lost his investment. The Gemara elsewhere has an expression, Chaisid Kitri Sabras for Kablos. You thought you're getting a bag full of knots, and that's what you got. In other words, you thought you knew you're taking a chance, you're buying a sealed bag, and you don't know what's in it, and you lost out. So he says that that expression may come from this story, because these guys thought all they're being hit with is an empty bag, and they didn't realize that there's a weapon inside it. Anyway, the Gemara continues. Nofek v'ase Yosef ka'ochel v'shasi. So afterwards, after he was saved from the Ludoi, he went. So nofek v'ase. So he went out. Now the Gemara continues another story about Rish Lakish in this connection. Yosef ka'ochel v'shasi. Rish Lakish was sitting and eating and drinking and like spending all his money and not worrying about what's going to be the next day. This was, Rashi says, we're not just talking a one-time thing here. After the story with the Ludoi, his whole life he continued acting that way. Omrele Brate, so Rish Lakish's daughter asks him, don't you at least want something to lean on? Don't you at least want a pillow or a cushion to sleep on or to sit on? Omrele, and the answer is, Biti, my daughter, Crazy Cree, my stomach is my pillow. Tosfos points out there were other places in the Gemara where it seems Rish Lakish would regularly lie on his stomach. There's a Gemara in Zvachim that actually mentioned that one time Rish Lakish was lying on his stomach and asking the following question. That same Gemara in Bav Metzia, where it talks about him doing tshuva, also mentions that he was a very large person, so like his own body was well cushioned. He didn't really need a cushion to lie on. And the Gemara finishes off, Ki noch nafshe, when Rish Lakish passed away, shavak kaba de marika. He left over as an inheritance for his children one kav of saffron. Now, saffron is an expensive spice, but still, it's not very much. But kori anafshe, but Rish Lakish said on himself the pasuk, v'ozvula chelam, they, people, when they pass away, they leave over their wealth for others. So what does he mean by that? So one point, so Marsha says the point is, in other words, that he's bemoaning the fact that he left over anything. Really, it should be we were just saying he used his money throughout his life. It shouldn't have to be that a person is worried about, I need to leave an estate for my children. You were given resources by Hashem, and they're meant for you to use. And if there's, and you know, especially Rish Lakish, a tzaddik, knows how to use them in the best way. In fact, he brings from a Gemara in, He brings from a Gemara in Erevin that a person shouldn't be planning to leave over an estate for his children. A person should be planning that whatever you have, whatever resources Hashem gave you, you use during your lifetime, and don't worry about the future. Hashem will take care of that. So that's one reason why he says that's one. You never know, that Gemara says in Erevin, whether his children themselves might keep his wealth intact or whether they might squander it. So he's bemoaning the fact, why did I leave over anything? There's another explanation, another one of the Mephoshim, Ein Eliyahu, and Mephoshim, Ein Yaakov, explains We said before that Rish Lakish in for a period of time in his youth was a thief. So therefore, so what happened was, so that means he had the, so everything, so at that time, at least everything he had was stolen from others. Now, over the years, what he should have been doing was to return whatever he had to the people he stole from without even, now you have a concept in halacha called misadrin lebal choyv. Suppose you have a person who owes a lot of money to people. So then when Beis Din comes to take away possessions of his to sell, to raise money, to cover the debt, they're supposed to leave him certain things, including, for example, a bed and a pillow and whatever. Here with a goslin, you don't have that. That is why Rish Lakish never had a pillow. That's why he was saying, just I'll sleep on my stomach. Because anything that he had, any pillows that he had, he would right away sell in order to raise money to somehow pay back the people he had stolen from, or if he doesn't know who those people are specifically, then to do tzorchei rabim with them. So now he felt bad that he left over this one calf of saffron that he hadn't been able to deal with before he passed away. So in other words, the Ein Elyo was saying, not like Maharsha, who's saying that any person should be acting like that. He says specifically in this case, because he had been a Gazlan. So that's the story with a yid selling himself to a goy. Mishnah continues, another case involving selling to goyim and also a matter of tikkun ha'olam. So the previous Mishnah, the point was that, again, it was a matter of tikkun ha'olam. The Mishnah didn't specify, but the idea was it was mipnei tikkun ha'olam, because again, otherwise, if you keep on ransoming the guy again and again, then he's just going to have an incentive to be matriach on the tzibur to do that. And mipnei tikkun ha'olam, then we want to prevent that. So now, continuing on, Mipnei Tikkun Olam, the Mishnah says, if a yid, we're going to see whether this is talking about in Eretz Yisrael or in Syria, but if a yid sells his field to a goy, he still has to buy the first fruits back from the goy and bring them as bikurim. And the reason is, Mipnei Tikkun Olam, because of Tikkun Olam, so that people are not, don't have too much of an incentive to sell land in Eretz Yisrael to goyim. And this way, also, if he did sell it, he's going to have to be matriach to go and buy back. So therefore, that'll give him an incentive to not sell in the first place. Tosfos has a slightly different girsa, not like keach u mevi bikurim, that he has to buy the fruit from the goy and bring it as bikurim. Rather, Tosfos says the girsa is, the Gir says, lekeach mevi bikurim, that if any person buys this land or buys this fruit from the goy, then they have to bring bikurim from it. So that's what I explained. They mean now that if any other yid, not necessarily the original seller, but if any other yid buys the produce of this land from a goy, then he has to bring bikurim from it. And the reason is, so that way, we incentivize that people shouldn't be selling land to goyim, and they should realize that the kedusha of it still applies. So now the Gemara starts off. Let's talk about that matter of what kedusha there is on land that was sold to goyim, which we talked about it a little bit the other day. So Omar Rabba, af al pi she'ein kinyan la'ovid kachavim be'eretz Yisrael la'achkiyah midei ma'aser, even though a goy does not have the concept of being able to acquire land in Eretz Yisrael to the extent of patterning it from Meiser, Shenema ki li ha'oretz, because the pasuk says, Hashem says, the land is mine, and therefore selling it to a goy doesn't have the power to change that. Meaning, in other words, therefore, so if a yid buys the produce from him, that yid will be responsible to take Meiser from it. And the Rambam also adds a point, which is going to relate to what we're going to say soon in the Gemara, that if later on a yid buys that land from the goy, we don't call it kibush yochid. The Gemara is going to soon discuss the point that, for example, we have the area called Syria, which includes parts of present-day Syria and Lebanon and maybe even Iraq and parts of Jordan and whatever. All of those were conquered by David HaMelech without the consent of the Sanhedrin, and therefore they're called kibush yochid. So they have a din sort of halfway between Eretz Yisrael and the rest of the world. But so now the Rambam says, if a goy buys land in Eretz Yisrael, obviously as long as he owns the land and as long as he owns the produce, Truma and Meiser are not going to be taken from it. But not only are we saying that if a yid buys the produce, he would have to take Meiser, but also the point is, if the goy eventually sells the land to a yid, then we don't call it kibush yachid. It still retains its original kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, and therefore the yid is chayiv in terumas and maisers. So Rabbah is saying, even though that's true, So, means li kedusha sa'aretz. Hashem is saying the kedusha of the land still belongs to me. Avo yesh kinyan lo'ev kachav me'aretz Yisrael lach ba'boris shichinu ma'aretz. But a goy is considered to have ownership of the land of Eretz Yisrael to the extent where he can dig boris shichinu ma'aretz, various kinds of water pits in it. And we don't say, for example, that a yid shouldn't be allowed to drink from those water pits. We say that the goy has a legitimate goy who has the ownership of the land right now is legitimately allowed to do such things to make alterations to the land like that. Shenema, because after all, the pasuk says Hashemayim Shemayim LaHashem VaAretz Nasan LeBnei Adam. The heavens are the heavens of Hashem, but the earth He gave to mankind, and that means LeBnei Adam means everybody, even goyim, because Bnei Adam means everybody descended from Adam. So that's what Rabbah is saying. Tosfos over here brings up a point that we learned the other day, that when a yid is a sharecropper or whatever, or a partner or whatever, a sharecropper or various other things with a goy in land in Eretz Yisrael, then that land is still potter from Meiser. So Tosfos says over here, we talked about it over there, that that Gemara may be talking about only in Syria. So in Syria, the fact that the goy owns the land is enough to completely potter it from Meiser. But over here, we're talking about in Eretz Yisrael proper, that wouldn't be the case. And then Tosfos goes on to discuss certain other aspects of this point, of whether of selling land to a goy, to what extent it makes it potter, and so forth. There are other places in Shas that implies that that it would be potter from Meiser, but the answer is we're going to actually have different opinions in our Mishnah over here, in our Gemara over here, and therefore those Mishnayos can be following one of those opinions. That's Rabbah. But Rabbi Lozer, whereas Rabbi Lozer says no. On the contrary, even though a goy's acquisition of land in Eretz Yisrael is in fact considered a kinyan to the extent where it potters the land from Meiser, so if a yid buys that produce from the goy, then it would be still potter from Meiser. Nevertheless, says Rabbi Lozer, I will ain't kin and lo'ev kachavim be'eretz Yisrael lachba b'bordes shichin u'moris. However, the goy does not have permission, al pi Torah, to dig ditches and pits and wells and whatever in it. Shenema la'ashem u'oritz, because the pasuk says the land belongs to Hashem. So that means that he can't alter the land. He can grow crops on it, and the crops are potter from Meiser, but not to go alter the land in a way that particular area can't be planted anymore, let's say. So the Gemara says, B'maikum mithli. So what's the underlying machloikas between Rabbah and Rebbe Lazar? Like this, the Pasuk says that you have to give Truma and Meiser from Digon Cha. Now, Dagon means grain, but specifically Dagon means the grain after the processing of it has been completed and it's been stacked up in a pile and Meruach has been done. So, Mar Sava Dagoncha V'loy Dagan Oved Gachavim. So, Rabbi Lozer holds that Dagoncha means to exclude where it's Dagon that was grown by a goy. So even though you, the Yid, bought it from him, and you processed it and you did the meruach and all of that, nevertheless, since it was grown by a goy, then therefore it's potter. Well, Mar Sava, whereas Rabbah holds digun chavale digun over gechavim. It doesn't go based on when it was first grown as dagon, but rather when the digun was done. Digun means when it's made into dagon by doing meruach. So Rabbah says, if the goy did meruach on it and it was still his at the time, then yeah, at that point it would be potter from Meiser. But if it was grown in a goy's land and then a yid bought it before it was processed and he did meruach, then Rabbah says it would be chayiv in Meiser because we can't say, so that's where he gets. Therefore, that ain kinyan lo'ev kachavim be'eretz Yisrael lafkia midei Meiser. His ownership of the land does not take away the obligation of Meiser. As long as the yid processed it, then we would still have to take Meiser from it, even though it was grown in a goy's land. So Tosfos actually discusses this further, and he says that he says somewhat differently than Rashi, that we're saying And the fact is, Tosfos says, again, you have a number of places where Tanoim discuss this point, whether what's the din as far as miruach over the chavim, whether it's potter or not. Are you going to say that Rabbah and Rabbi Lazar are just repeating the machlokas of all those Tanoim? And Tosfos points out some other things. So therefore, Tosfos says that no, what it means is that the Rabbi Lazar is saying that that you have both. You need Rabbi Lazar is saying the fact is the pasuk doesn't say tuascha; it only says digoncha. So therefore, we can learn both things from it, that it has to be that it was grown by a yid and that it was processed by a yid. So in this case, it was grown by a yid, then therefore he says it would be potter. Now he has a separate machloikas where it was only grown. You have a separate machloikas tanoim. In cases where, let's say, where it was grown by a yid and then processed by a goy, would it be potter or not? So Rabbi Lazar is not really addressing that point. And then Tosfos Yeshanim discusses that point further, that they can both be arguing with it. Rabbi and Rabbi Lazar can both be arguing within the opinion that yesh kinyan lo'ev kachavim laftia, that they both agree a goy does have the ability to remove the chiyuv of meiser from produce that he grew. But the question is whether when the yid bought it from the goy, did he buy it before it reached a certain stage of its growth or afterwards? The fact that he bought it while it was attached to the ground, maybe even, does that make a difference? And so on and so forth. So the Rav Mar says, Omer Rabba, Menoa Minala. So Rabba says, where am I getting this from? That even though the goy has bought land in Eretz Yisrael, nevertheless, the produce of it is chayev and meiser. So Ditinan, we learn in the Mishnah, Haleket Vashikcha Vapeya Shal Ovi Gifavim, Chayovin Memeiser, Leket Shikcha and Peya of Goyim, the Pashtos, it means that a Goy left them in his field, Chayovin Memeiser, then they are Chayovin Meiser, Elim Ken Hefker, unless he declared them Hefker, because if he declared them Hefker, then Hefker is Potter from Meiser. So, Hechi Dami, so Rabbah says, you have to consider, what's the scenario when we're calling it Leket Shikcha and Peya of a Goy? If you're saying that it was leket shikcha peya that was left by a yid, but instead of a Jewish poor person collecting them, a goy did. Well, then what do you mean elim ken hefker? So what do you mean only if he declared them hefker are they potter? The fact is, right now they are hefker because all leket shikcha and peya are hefker. So what's the difference whether a goy collected them or not? So we must be talking about a field that belongs to a goy, and the goy decided to leave leket shikcha and peya, and we're talking about that a yid collected them. Time of dehifkir. So we're saying only because the yid collected them, then therefore. So time of dehifkir. So only if the goy declared them hefker, then they'd be potter from miser. Ha loy hefker. But if the goy did not chayev, then the yid would be chayev to take miser. Showing why, because the goy, the goy's leket shikcha and peya is not chayev and peya. So therefore, Rabbah is saying, you see though that a goy's produce is chayev and meiser. So once the goy doesn't keep it for himself, once he gives it and allows a yid to take it, then the yid has to take meiser from it. So there you go, says Rabbi. You see, therefore, that produce of a goy is chayev and meiser unless he was mafter it. So that's Rabbi's point. But the Gemara says loy, not necessarily is that the correct way to understand the Mishnah. Rabbi Lazar might answer, lo'olam di'Yisrael v'lektinu ovid k'chavim. Maybe in fact we are talking about produce of a yid which a goy collected. You're saying, so what? It's already hefker. Why should it be chayev in truma and meiser unless the landowner was mafker it? On the face of it, it's hefker anyway, because leket shikcha and peya is always mafker. The answer is nihi. So the ka'amar to mafker v'kaimi nihi de mafker yadaita de Yisrael. It is true that the owner makes it hefker, having in mind that Jews will take it. Adaita de kachavim mafkeri. Was he mafker it, having in mind that a goy is going to go and collect it? Because leket shikcha and peya is basically meant for Jews to take. So therefore, so when the goy takes it, then it's not considered that it was left as hefker in the first place. So therefore, it should be chayiv and meiser unless the yid is actually explicitly mafker it. So you could understand the Mishnah that way. So it's not necessarily talking about where the goy left like a chitchan peya. It could be actually talking about where the yid left like a chitchan peya, and then the goy collected it. Mishnah Melech actually makes an interesting point on this. He says, you see from this, therefore, that we always say that Peya and the other Lekat Shitchan Peya are potter from Meiser, that would only be, the Mishnah Melech says, once a Yid, an Oni, picks it up, then it's potter from Meiser. Before he picks it up, it's Chayev. He says, that's what you see from this Gemara over here, that's why if a Yid didn't pick it up and a Goy did, then it still remains Chayev and Meiser. And then Rav Akiva Eger and other Achronim point out some difficulties with that. There is a different explanation that some of the Rishonim say that here we're talking about where there's no Jewish poor people in town. So to begin with, when the Jewish landowner is leaving Lechet Shikhan Peya, then he realizes there may not be any yid who's going to take it, and therefore he's not fully mafker it. So only if he's explicitly mafker it, then in that case, then we would say, so the Ritva says that we're talking about, for example, the Ritva, I mean, Kreskas, others say that we're talking about where there's no poor people, there's no Jewish poor people, so therefore it's not yet hefker. Okay. So therefore, so no proof, no solid proof one way or the other from that a goy's produce is chayev and meiser, because you could learn the Mishnah as talking about that a goy left this lekat shitchan peya, but you could equally well learn the Mishnah that it's talking about that a yid left it and a goy came and collected it. Okay, the Gemara says, Toshma, let's try to bring another proof. A Braisa says, Yisrael shalokach sodom erit gechavim ad shalei yivyeshlish. If a yid bought a field from a goy before the produce in the field reached one third of its growth, v'chazer u'mocher lo mishi yivyeshlish, and then he resold it to the goy after it grew one third, and then later on the yid bought the produce and did miruach with it. So then it's chayev and meiser shekvarn is chayva, because it had already become chayev and meiser. Because when does it become chayev and meiser? When's the first stage of produce becoming chayev and meiser? Is when it develops to a certain degree, when it develops to one third of its growth. Then at that point, if you harvest it, then and you do all the processing with it, then it's chayev and meiser. So here we have when it reached shlish in the possession of the Yisrael, then it became chayev and meiser. Implying the schaiva ein loin is schaiva loy. So the implication is only because it became chayev, only because he bought it before it was one third grown, and then it grew to its one third stage in the hands of the yid. But if not, then we would say it's potter. So wouldn't that show, like Rabbi Lazar, that a goy's ownership of Eretz Yisrael potters it from meiser? The answer is no. Hocha meiskin and besuria. Because we could be saying that this Braisa is talking about in Syria, those various lands that David conquered without the permission of the Sanhedrin, because there's a Medrash that says on it that when he conquered those lands, the Sanhedrin told him, look, you're Samach Lepaltin Shalchol Kavashta, you haven't even can't conquer all the parts of Eretz Yisrael near your palace, because right there in Yerushalayim, there were still enclaves of Goyim over there. You have at the end of David's life, he went to Aravna Hayavusi and bought the site of the Beis Mikdash from him. So therefore, the Sanhedrin is telling him, you haven't even cleared out all the seven nations from Eretz Yisrael proper. What are you going and fighting against foreign countries and conquering them? So for that reason, those places are considered Kibush Yochid v'Kosavar. So the Tana of this Braisa holds Kibush Yochid, Loi Shmei Kibush. This Kibush that was done by an individual, Rashi says it means that all the Jewish people were not there. So what we mean is, in other words, that the Sanhedrin, which represents the whole Jewish people, hadn't consented to it. So therefore, so loy shmei kibush, such a thing is not considered a conquest in halacha, and therefore Syria does not have the full dinim of Eretz Yisrael. Back on Daf Ches of Or Masechta, we had something about that. We said there were three ways in which Syria is similar to Eretz Yisrael, and three ways in which it's similar to Chutz Laaretz, and one of them had to do with these things. We said that it is chayev and meiser and shvius like Eretz Yisrael, but on the other hand, we're saying that a goy's ownership of it is enough to take off that kedusha of it, such that now it's not chayev and truma and meiser anymore. So you could say, in the special case we're talking about over here, where the yid bought produce before it was one-third grown and grew to its one-third stage in his possession, then yeah, you could say then it's chayiv and maisa because of that, but ordinarily no. Actually, earlier on Daf Ches, Rashi makes that same point. He says that it was kibush yochid because not all the Jews were there. So in other words, Rashi is learning. It's not so much a matter of the Sanhedrin. Rashi learns, Tosfos explains over there on Daf Ches, that what it means is David didn't bring the entire Jewish army to conquer these lands. He only brought part of them. So by Yeshua, they were conquering on behalf of the whole Jewish people. Whereas here, David is conquering it kind of only as his own personal purposes, that it should be kind of his personal kingly estate or something. And then Tosfos brings over there the point from the Sifri that all of Eretz Yisrael proper had not yet been conquered. So two different ways of understanding why it's called Kibush Yochid. According to Tosfos, if David in fact had conquered and dispossessed the Goyim from all of Eretz Yisrael proper, then even though here he didn't bring the entire army, it still would have been considered Kibush Rabim and it would have become a part of Eretz Yisrael proper, and only because he did things out of order did it not. Whereas according to Rashi, it's a matter of that he was doing it essentially as a private fief of his own rather than as a private estate of his own rather than on behalf of the whole Jewish people. Okay. So that Braisa is talking about Surya, so not necessarily a proof that the same thing would apply in Eretz Yisrael proper. The Gemara continues, Toshma, Yisrael v'ov g'chavim shalokhu sada b'shutkus, if a Yid and a Goy buy a field in partnership, so even though now afterwards they go and split up the produce between them, nevertheless, tevel b'cholin mo'uravin zebezeh divir debi. Rebbe says, you have tevel and cholin mixed together. So Rashi says, in effect, each grain of wheat is half tevel and half cholin. The goy's part is going to be potter. The yid's part is chayev. So therefore, when the yid takes truma and maaser for it, now he won't be able to say, for example, okay, I have a hundred bushels of wheat over here. So I'm going to take some other produce of mine that I already have in my granary, and I'll take two bushels of it as truma on behalf of this. You can't, because the other one is not yet chayev. The other one is completely chayev and truma. This one is only half chayev because each grain of wheat belongs half to him and half to the goy. So therefore, he would have to take truma and maaser from within this crop itself. That's how Rashi learns. So that way, it comes out when he's taking from this crop on itself, then fine, each grain of wheat that he separates, the part we consider that the part that's chayev is going on the part that's chayev, and the part that's potter is on the part that's potter. That's how Rashi learns. Tosfos says differently, it's not so much that within each grain of wheat, it means really that each grain of wheat is a suffix whether it belongs to him or whether it belongs to the goy, because as the Gemara is going to say soon, ein breira. So therefore, again, he would have to take meiser from within it itself. But actually, Tosfos says no, he could actually take meiser from it on behalf of somebody on behalf of other produce or vice versa. What the problem would be though, that Tosfos says he would be able to use this as meiser on behalf of other produce, but the problem is that other produce, you'd always have a certain degree of suffix, how much of it has been meisered until there's only very little left. And then eventually all that truma and meiser will have to be given to the Levi, to the Kohen and the Levi respectively. So according to Rashi, the point is that you can only take maaser from within this produce itself. According to Tosfos, you could in fact use it on behalf of other produce or use other produce on behalf of it, but you'd still have that concern about whether everything has been done properly. So the Gemara says, so that was Rebbe. Reb Shimon Gamliel, Mishal Oed Kachavim Potter, Rishoy Yisrael Chayim. Reb Shimon Gamliel says, whatever the Goy took is Potter, whatever the Yid took is Chayim. So ad kan le pligi ella de mar sava yesh breira or mar sava ein breira. So the whole machloka seems to be Reb Shimon Gamliel is saying yesh breira. So he says after the goy and the yid have divided the grain between them, then we can say retroactively every grain of wheat that the goy got was his all along, and every grain that the yid got was his all along. Therefore, we can take truma and maaser from it normally or on behalf of other produce and not have a problem. And Rebbe would hold there is that issue because he would say ein breira, and therefore we would say that tevel v'cholin mo'uravin zebezeh, like we said, tevel and cholin are mixed up with one another. But it sounds Aval to Kol Alma Yeshkin and La'ivik Kachav Be'etzi Yisrael Afki Yemidem Yad Ma'aser. But it sounds like they both do agree that the goy's ownership of land in Eretz Yisrael takes away the obligation of Ma'aser. Because otherwise, what do you mean? Tevul v'chol and mo'rav and zebezeh. The whole thing would be chayiv and Ma'aser. And how would Rav Shimon Gamliel be saying shel La'ivik Kachav and Potter? The answer is you could say Hochanami Basuria. Here also you could say that this Braisa is talking about Suria because of Kibush Yochad Loishme Kibush. And again, the Tana of this Braisa, or both Rebbe and Rav Shimon Gamliel, would be holding that the Kibush Yochid, the fact that David conquered Syria without the whole Jewish army, or not on behalf of the whole Jewish people, or before he had conquered the rest of Eretz Yisrael, is not considered a Kibush. But in Eretz Yisrael proper, they wouldn't necessarily have this machloikas, because maybe they would both hold that yet that ain't Kinyan La'ivik Kachavim Lafkia, and therefore that the land of Eretz Yisrael still is Chayev in Truma and Meiser, even if right now the land is owned by a goy. Okay. The Gemara says, "Amar Abchir ba'Oven Toshma." Let's try to bring another proof. A Braisa says, "Amoichus." Actually, our Mishnah. This is why we're bringing in this whole discussion over here, because it relates back to our Mishnah. We said, "Amoichus sadeu la'ur tuchavim." If a yid sold his field to a guy, lekeach maybe bikurim, then the buyer, the lekeach maybe bikurim, he has to buy the produce and bring bikurim. That was how Rashi learned. We said Tosfos learned rather that it means whoever it is that buys the produce from the goy brings bikurim. Mipnei tikkun olam, because of tikkun olam, implying. So that seems to imply mipnei tikkun olam ain. So only the chachamim made a takana because of tikkun olam that he should bring bikurim. Midaraisa loy. Apparently midaraisa he'd be potter from bikurim. So that shows, like Rebbe Lazar, the fact that the goy owns the land now takes away the kedusha of it, and therefore it's potter from bikurim. And only because the chachamim are requiring the yid to buy them from the goy mipnei tikkun olam, or as Tosfos says, any yid who buys them from the goy should bring bikurim mipnei tikkun olam. So that shows what Rebbe Lazar is saying, that basically the goy's ownership of the land does take away the chiyuv of bikurim as well as of truma and meiser, and only if the yid buys the produce from him, then we have a special takana of the chachamim mipnei tikkun olam that he should be bringing bikurim. So the answer is Amar Rav Ashi. So Rav Ashi says no, because what the Mishnah means is shtei takonis habu. There were actually two different takonis that the Chachamim made over here. What happened was like this: Miikra have a maisi midaraisa. Originally, people who sold the land would still continue to bring bikurim from it on a daraisa level, because they followed Rabba's opinion that the land is still chayev and truma and maisus and bikurim. Even the chazu to come mikri umizabni. But then the Chachamim saw that there were cases where people were selling the land to the goyim, just sabri, because they figured, what's the problem? The shasayu kaiman. Look, the land still retains its kedusha, so therefore there should be no problem selling it to a goy. They figured, in other words, look, if we're taking away the kedusha of Eretz Yisrael by selling it to a goy, then sure, we're not going to do that. But if it's not taking away the kedusha anyhow, then what would be the problem with selling it? By the way, Rashi points out over here that when it comes to bikurim, now unlike truma and meiser, where you can't eat the produce until you take truma and meiser, bikurim is not so. Bikurim wouldn't prevent, not bringing bikurim would not prevent people from being able to eat the produce. So bikurim is a mitzvah that's incumbent on the person. So now Rav Ashi is saying it was midaraisa, they are in fact chayav. What we're saying is, but people figured that there's no harm in selling land to a goy. We won't be punished for it, Rashi says, because what's the problem? It still retains its kedusha anyhow. Therefore, takinu lahu delay laisu. Therefore, the chachamim made a takana that they should not bring bikurim from these fields. That way, they should realize that there is, in fact, an issue involved. So again, the Chacham didn't want to say that they shouldn't be taking truma and meiser, because the fact is the payrus are still going to be also to eat. Until you take ma'aser from them, but they could take away the obligation of bringing bikurim, because because bikurim is a mitzvah. Rashi explains bikurim is a mitzvah incumbent on the person. It's a chayvus haguf. So it doesn't prevent them from eating the produce. I think the Chassam Sofer it is that points out, you see from here a precedent where the Chachamim can say that you shouldn't keep a certain mitzvah because of problems with the Goyim. And he gives an example of that. It's brought in Shulchan Aruch, for example. There were places where Goyim would hike up the prices of fish before Shabbos, figuring we have a captive market. Goyim, we know that Jews eat fish for Shabbos. So therefore, they'll pay any of our prices. And it's brought in Shulchan Aruch that in that case, you should have to boycott them and not buy fish. You're supposed to have fish for Shabbos, but if they're going to be acting like that, then you don't. So here we have an example where we see exactly that because, so actually the Chassam Sofer says that the Rambam learns our Gemara slightly differently, that it wasn't so much that Jews are selling it to Goyim and figuring that there's not a problem, there's a slightly different Gersa, not Mikri, but Miyakri. That they're charging higher prices for it. So therefore, the Chachamim are going to take away the chiyuv of mice of bikurim in order that this way Goyim won't think that, in other words, you won't have that Goyim are going to be trying to buy land in Eretz Yisrael and overcharging when a Jew wants to buy it back from them. But then the Chachamim saw that kind of backfired. Demand of a sagile, a person who doesn't have enough money, Mizabin is anyway selling his property to Goyim, and the Kamishtakan, and it ends up remaining permanently in the hands of the Goy, in the hands of the Goy, because the person figures, if I'm not bringing Bikurim from it anyhow, then why should I bother being Poydeh? So therefore, Takinu, so then the Chachamim put back the original thing that they should bring Likurim, but that was Mipnei Tikkun Olam. At this point, having made the first Takana, so now in effect, they're restoring things the way they were originally. So it was Midaraisa, it becomes Midaraisa again, but the reason why they're doing it is Mipnei Tikkun Olam, in order to give Jews an incentive like this, the Yid should think, I want to be able to bring Bikurim. And you find the Shnayis and Bikurim, they had a whole procession, and everybody in Yerushalayim came and gave them great honor and everything. So therefore, a person will have more of an incentive to buy back the produce, in order to bring Bikurim. And therefore, the Chachamim said you should do that, and that way, at least, it makes it more likely that the Yid is not going to leave that land in the hands of the Goy permanently, because he does want to be able to bring Bikurim. And as Rashi points out, it's one thing, Truma and Maisu, he figures he's gaining like this. Okay, the thing is Potter from Truma and Maisu that I'm gaining. I don't have to give away 10% of it to the Levi and so on and so forth, whereas Bikurim is a much smaller amount. Okay, so since we're talking about Bikurim, let's talk about more on that subject. We have a discussion of Amiroim. If a person sells his field only as far as the payrus, so Reuven owns a field, he sells it to Shimon as far as the payrus, meaning Shimon, your rights over the land are exclusively that you can have the payrus of it. Now, it's not considered davar shalei bala olam because the field exists right now. So, but the idea is, Rashi is saying, he's saying, let's say you're going to be able to have the fruit of this land for the next 10 years, and after that, I'm getting back the land. Meanwhile, in between, Shimon is, for example, not allowed to dig ditches in the land or do things like that. But Rashi also points out we have to be talking about when the Yovel is not in effect. When the Yovel is in effect, always selling is for payrus because the land itself always returns to the owner in Yovel. So if a person sells a field only for payrus, Rabbi Yechanan says Shimon, the buyer, brings Bikurim from that field for the next 10 years, and he says the Psukim. Yeah, you have the Psukim that it says in Parshas Kisavai, Arami Ovid Ovi, Vayered Mitzrayma, Vayereo Esanam Mitzrim, etc. You say those Psukim when you bring Bikurim. So Rabbi Yochanan holds you can actually say those Psukim as well. Resh Lakish, maybe Ve'ene Kore, Resh Lakish says he brings Bikurim, but he does not say the Psukim for reasons that we're going to explain now. Rabbi Yochanan, maybe the Kore, because he holds Kinyan Peres, Kinyan Aguf Dami. Owning the payrus is the equivalent of owning the goof. So therefore, it's considered for these 10 years that he actually owns the land. So therefore, now at the end, after the end of the psukim over there, you say the expression that I'm bringing Bikurim from land, Asher Nosato Li Hashem, that you, Hashem, have given me. Well, he can validly say that because Hashem did give him the land. It's considered that he owns the land. Resh Lakish maybe the any kore, whereas Resh Lakish says not, because he holds kinin payrus lavka kinin aguf dami. He holds that owning the payrus is not the equivalent of owning the goof. So therefore, he can't say Hashem nasata li Hashem. So the Gemara says Eisvei Rabbi Yochanan Resh Lakish. So Rabbi Yochanan pointed out to Resh Lakish a contradiction. You're telling me the guy doesn't say the psukim, but we learn in a brisa the pasuk finishes off that when you bring bikurim, it says v'samachta b'cholatoyv, you should be happy with all the goodness Hashem gave you. And the pasuk finishes off that Hashem gave you ulavei secha and to your household. Now, ulavei secha melamed shadam maybe bikurim ishtoy. From here, we learn that a man can bring bikurim from his wife's field, where ishtoy beisoy zu ishtoy. So his wife is called his household. So he can bring. So if you have land, Rashi explains that nichsim malug. So she owns the land, but he owns the peiros. So that's an example of kinyan peiros. So he can bring bikurim from it, and he can say that. And he can say the psukim malamicha adam maybe bikurim ishtay v'kurim. So you see from that that even if he only owns kinyan peiros, because that's how it is with nichsim malug, nevertheless he can still say the psukim. Amalei. So Rish Lakish answers shiny hasam. It's different in that case, because it says, then therefore you have, then the Torah is telling you, and then that special case, then you can say the psukim, but otherwise not. In other words, the Ritva explains that Rish Lakish would say that even if you didn't have any kinyan in the kaka, even if you didn't have kinyan peiros at all, but gzeiros hakasev would be that he could bring bikurim from his wife's land. Let's say she had land that completely belonged to her, and he had, like we learned in Kesubas, he could say, for example, ainli esek, I have no interest and no concern with this field at all. Nevertheless, the Ritva is saying, Reb Shlokish would say, based on that pasuk, that he could bring bikurim and say the psukim, but otherwise not, because he only has kinyan peiros. Persimus points out, by the way, the whole concept of kinyan peiros, the whole concept that the husband gets the peiros of the wife's property is anyway only dirabanan. So how are we learning it from a pasuk over here? So Tosfos says, okay, because the fact is, even before the takanas chachamim, it was a usual thing that the wife would give the peiros to her husband. Because in other words, the fact is, since he's supporting her, then it's a normal thing that she gives him the peiros of her nichsim malug, even before the chachamim made a formal takana to that effect. With that said, there are Rishonim who learn that the Gemara is saying it over here only as an asmachta, that it's not that we're not that we're actually necessarily learning from the psukim, from the pasuk itself, that it's only an asmachta, because the fact is the concept of his kinyan peiros is only dirabban. Now there's another version of how the argument went. According to the second version, Esved Shlokish Lerabbi Yochanan. On the contrary, Shlokish asks Rabbi Yochanan, Ulvei Secha, Malaman Sha'adam, maybe Bikurei Ishti V'Korei, that you have this pasuk that says, Ulvei Secha, that because he's bringing Bikurim from his wife, that he can bring Bikurim from his wife's field and say the psukim. So wouldn't that imply, only because in that special case, because it says Ulvei Secha, then therefore he does that. Implying that generally a person who owns only peiros does not say the psukim. Amalei, so Rabbi Yochanan tells him, no problem. I'm getting my opinion precisely from here. I hold the Torah is not saying only by a husband and wife. It's saying in general, anytime that there's kinyan peiros, then it's considered like kinyan karka, and therefore it can be considered that he owns it. So the Gemara continues, Esve. So Rish Lakish says to Rabbi Yochanan, in that case, I have another contradiction. A Braisa says, Hoya Baba Derech, if a person was coming on the road to Yerushalayim, or Bikure Ishte Biyodei, he has his wife's Bikurim in his hands, Vishama Shemesa Ishtei, on the way he hears that his wife died, maybe the Kore, he still brings the Bikurim, and he still says the Psukim. So Mesa Aimloy Mesa Loy. So the implication is only because she died and he inherits her. So now he owns the goof of the karka, implying Loy Mesa Loy, implying if she didn't die, then he wouldn't be able to say the psukim because he has only kinyan peiros. So therefore, Rish Lakish says, so you see that kinyan peiros is not considered like kinyan aguf. The answer is Loy, not necessarily. No, you could say it means actually, even if she didn't die, he could still say the psukim. Umesa it's tirichalei. The chiddush would be when he died, when she died. So sabdar chamina ligzo mishum derab yosi bachanina. You would think that maybe you should make a gzera that you have to compare it to a case that Rabbi Yosi bachanina says. If the person harvested the fruit and he sent it with a shliach to Yerushalayim, instead of bringing it himself, he sent it with a shliach. Umes shliach baderech. Then the shliach died on the way. So now the owner comes and takes the produce and continues the job of bringing it to Yerushalayim himself. then maybe the Ene Kore, then he brings the Bikurim, but he doesn't say the Psukim, Shenem of Alakachta Vehevesa, because the Pasuk says you should bring the produce and you should take the produce and you should bring it, implying Ajne Lakicha Vavar Be'echad. It has to be that the same person was taking it and bringing it. And here it's not, because you sent it with a Shliach, and therefore, and now you yourself are bringing it. So you would think, by the same token over here, when the wife has property and the husband is bringing Bikurim from it, and now she dies on the way, maybe we should compare that to Rabbi Yossi Bachanina's case and say that people are going to think that the same thing, people are going to think that he's like a shliach, that he wouldn't have, that while his wife was alive, he shouldn't have been saying the psukim either, and only he's saying the psukim because she died on the way. Then they're going to think the same thing is true of a shliach. Kamash Malon, therefore the Braisa is telling us that's not an issue, and in fact he could say the psukim. Tosfos mentions, now there's a Gemara in Baba Basra that also talks about dinim of Bikurim and also talks about this matter of sending it with a shliach and all that. And Tosfos brings that the Rashbam over there explains that it means that the husband or whoever it was, the owner, when he harvested it and sent it with a shliach, meaning not the if the shliach himself harvested the fruit, then sure, the shliach would be then the shliach wouldn't be saying then the only the owner would be saying the psukim, because we would say the owner could say because shluch shalom kamoisei, and then he could say hine hevesi. On the other hand, then Rabbi Natam disagrees with that and discusses. So Tosfos ends up saying that no, what it means is usually we talk about the owner harvesting, because usually he does ba'ayin yofa. Given that there's no maximum shiur for Bikurim, then he wants to do ba'ayin yofa, he wants to bring it generously. So therefore, so it means that he harvested it, because usually the balabas does that, and then the shliach died on the way. So then usually it would be that you send somebody else with it. So then it's not v'lakachta v'hevesa, as opposed to, in other words, if the shliach had harvested them, it's not usual to do that, says Rabbi Natan, but nevertheless, then still you wouldn't be saying the psukim, because the fact is that he himself is not bringing it. Elsewhere also, Tosfos discusses in Baba Basra, is there a difference whether to begin, actually the Gemara itself discusses it over there, did he harvest them intending to begin with for the shliach to bring them, or is it in this case that he expected the shliach to bring them and unexpectedly the shliach died on the way? That would also make a difference, where if to begin with he harvested them intending to send them with a shliach, might be a different kind of thing than when he sends them with a shliach expecting for the shliach to bring them, and then in the end the shliach dies and he can't do it. In any case, the point is that Rish Lakish's question on Rabbi Yochanan, that the implication is only when the wife died, then maybe the kodesh, but otherwise not. So we're saying no, the chiddush is that even though she died, he can still be kodesh. But yes, certainly when she hasn't died, says Rabbi Yochanan, he could still be kodesh. He could still say the psukim, because up until that point he has kinyan peiros, and kinyan peiros is the equivalent, says Rabbi Yochanan, of kinyan aguf. So we'll continue that discussion tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, and deal with more dinim that come from this matter of Kinyan Peiros and Kinyan Aguf.